Good morning, everybody. Can we start? Can we start? Morning. That's not good. Let's check again. Besser. Danke schön. I just learned this morning that we only have 5 responses to the course evaluation, and I ordered 90 tons, so the feedback of the guys who are in charge of the evaluation asked me to encourage you to do the evaluation. And imagine if these 5 are just the frustrated guys in the audience, then it might give us some kind of biased view towards things. It's not my 5 tons that are considered so far. Good, so we are getting closer to the end of the semester. We still have a quite tough program. Maybe I lost too much time by telling stories about industry and hospitals, but we will look into a few important subtypes of reconstruction algorithms today, and then by Thursday we have to start with image fusion. So I skip the big picture today for the sake of new topics that we can squeeze in for the final lecture. I hope that with the registration of the oral exam, everything is going fine now. Yeah, everything is set up. I receive quite a few emails regarding how should I apply and how should I register, and I usually forward these things because I end up with the same questions like you, because I have never registered for this. And okay, we have seen so far 2 different types of image reconstruction techniques. Morning. One class of reconstruction algorithms is using the analytical approach, and the other part is using the algebraic approach. So algorithms that are based on algebra. And the second part, and this is something we are going to learn also today, is using statistical reconstruction algorithms. And just for us, for our understanding, here we do all the computations with the integral equations to the end, yeah, and discretize at the end of the day the method we have found. Filtered back projection, for instance, is based on the Fourier slice theorem that was proven in the continuous using analysis methods. Yeah, so we push through the consideration of the problem in the continuous until we end up with a reconstruction method, an analytical reconstruction method that we discretize at the end of the day. And in the algebraic approach, we use the numeric approximation of the integral. That means we replace the sum by, replace the integral by a sum right away at the beginning when we start to consider Bayer's law. Yeah? So we discretize in a very early stage of our algorithms. And here, we transform everything into a probabilistic context, and then we do a maximum likelihood estimation, saying compute the parameters that we are looking for. That means the object to be reconstructed in a way that some probabilities are maximized based on the observations. Huh? How that looks in detail, we are going to see today. So we are working with integrals, we are working with sums, and we are working with probabilities and maximum likelihood estimators. And with respect to algebraic reconstruction, we have seen that the reconstruction of a volume using X-ray projections can be rewritten in terms of a system of linear equations. Yeah? And each pixel that we measure contributes one equation for the system of equations we have. Each volume element, each voxel that we have to compute is one unknown. That means the number of unknowns of our system of equations is driven by the volume size that we want to reconstruct. And basically, we have AX is P. That's the system of linear equations we have to solve. And we won't be able to compute the inverse of this matrix right away, because most, or quite often, we have scenarios where we have more unknowns than equations. So we have ambiguities in the solutions, and we have to deal with that. And instead of solving this type of equation for x, we replace p minus ax is 0 by a numerical term saying that the squared Euclidean distance of these two vectors should be minimum. Yeah? So x is the volume we want to reconstruct, and we want to compute x in a way that this here, this difference here, is minimized. Okay, and if we have this linear setup, we can say the solution can even be written in closed form. Using the pseudo inverse that we also have seen within the context of the singular value decomposition. Okay. And this here requires the inversion of this matrix. And this is also something that we cannot do right away by using this Gram matrix. That's how it is named. Using the Gram matrix and computing its inverse, so we have to use numerical approximations. And we have seen last Thursday one iteration scheme with a geometric association of the system of linear equations, how we can iteratively get closer and closer to the point of intersection of these linear manifolds. And the intersection of linear manifolds means that the solution for the system of linear equation. Okay. In a more abstract way, we can say we have here a function of f minus of fp minus ax that has to be minimized, and in this case, f is just the squared Euclidean distance. And the reconstruction itself is thus an optimization problem. Let me just move this here a little bit up. Can I make this dark? Maybe this way. So reconstruction means we compute the minimum f of p minus ax. Once again, what is p, Stefan? What is p? Oh, come on, you have to ask if you don't remember that. These are the measured intensity values just packed into a vector. What is A? Huh? That's the measurement matrix. The system matrix. No, the system matrix that is characterized and given by the projection geometry, and we have to optimize this. Okay. If this is a quadratic function that has to be minimized, we know quadratic functions that can be minimized look like, quadratic function that are minimized look like this. So this is a convex function, and we look for this minimum. And we can compute the minimum value. That means, for instance, if it sits here, we can compute the x value for the minimum by a closed form solution. Because quadratic function means compute the derivative. The derivative of a quadratic function is linear, and the linear problem can be solved in closed form like this here. Okay? So we can compute a closed form solution for it. Quite often, we use numerical methods to compute the minimum of this function. And one way to do that is to do a gradient descent method. And that's one approach that is also applied quite often in algebraic reconstruction techniques. Instead of computing closed form, the point for the minimum, we set up an iterative scheme that does gradient descent. If I compute the gradient of the function, I get a vector. Where does this vector point to? Ascent. Yeah, the gradient always tells you in which direction does the function increase the most. So keep in mind the nice picture: you are in the Alps with your girlfriend or with your boyfriend, and your girlfriend or boyfriend asks you which direction should we go to reach the top of the mountain. Then you just sit there and say, no problem, I'm studying computer science, medical engineering at the University of Erlangen, I know how to do that. And then you just compute local differences, yeah, that's an approximation. And then you decide for the direction, then you decide for the direction where the ascent is maximum, okay? And if your girlfriend is really out of breath, and she says, I want to go back into the valley, I want to have a nice dinner with you, and blah, blah, blah. Then you have to compute the direction which guarantees that you find the valley as fast as possible. So what do? You compute the local differences, and you compute the gradient vector, chose into the direction where it has the steepest ascent, and you just put a minus, and you say, if it's this direction the steepest way, then it must be this direction the steepest descent, right? And you follow the negative direction of the gradient. And then you do one step, and then you recompute everything, and you follow the gradient direction into the steepest descent. Yeah? Yeah, the negative gradient direction. That's the picture you should have in mind, okay? And we call this method gradient descent. So what we do is we compute the slope here, and this is the slope, and we follow the negative slope by a certain amount. We say this is the new point. Then we compute the slope again. We follow this a certain amount, and then we follow the steepest descent direction, and then we end up in the closest local minimum. That's gradient descent, okay? Then Newton-Raphson minimization is very much similar, but instead of using the gradient and instead of using the steepest descent, with the problem, for instance, that you have to decide how many steps do I do before I start to recompute the gradient. Yeah, the number of steps, the widths of the jumps, that's something that has to be parameterized. And this is a serious problem in all these optimization techniques. How do I adjust the step size of my gradient descent method? And what mathematicians did, instead of using here a linear approximation for the gradient computation, they develop here or expand the function at the currently considered point by a Taylor series of degree 2 and compute the minimum of this in closed form, and then take this as the next point, develop here the second order Taylor expansion, compute the minimum, and then you iterate into this minimum, and it's converging way faster than than the gradient descent method and has a lot of other advantages. So what we do is, in many times, or in many, many situations, don't use here the Euclidean distance that has to be minimized or the Euclidean length that has to be minimized, but any other function that incorporates many terms that characterize the quality of the reconstruction result, and then apply a numerical method for minimization. And the easiest one and simplest one is the gradient descent method that we have summarized on the following slides here. Yeah? So that's the picture you have to keep in mind, and the rest is just mathematics. So what we do is formulate the reconstruction problem as an optimization problem, minimize a function in terms of the parameters that are unknowns. What is the x again in our setup? X is the vector that we end up with if we squeeze in all our voxel values that are unknown into a vector. Huh? These are the x values here. Then find an optimum via peak condition. That means we find an optimum using, for instance, this type of function and say the optimal solution is sitting here where this function achieves the minimum. And we follow the gradient method, or we follow the gradient, the negative gradient, to find the minimum. And there are different ways to do gradient descent or to compute numerically the minimum. For instance, we can use conjugate gradients. We can use the Newton-Raphson approximation. We can also extend here the objective function by an additional term, a regularizer. Regularizers we have seen on fuzzy means clustering in one of the previous chapters. So we add an additional term that incorporates prior knowledge on the object to be reconstructed. For instance, if you want to reconstruct just the vasculature in the human brain, that means the vessels and nothing else, then you can say most of the volume elements will be zero. And only at those points where we have vessels, we have non-zero values. And we could add here a term saying that we want to find a so-called sparse solution, a solution vector with as many zeros as possible, for instance. Yeah? With as many zeros as possible.
What is the graph a parabola?
Let us make a very simple example. It's not always a parabola. It's not always. It's just the example I have shown to you, motivated by this. If you have p is equal to ax, you can also consider p minus ax square and take the L2 norm, and if it's zero, so p minus ax, if it's zero, this equation is fulfilled. Okay, so I can also now say that p is a real value, a vector of dimension 1. So I have something like p minus ax square, and this is a scalar. That's a simplification. So I have p minus ax square. So I have ax square minus 2 times pax plus p square. And I want to minimize this with respect to x. So you will get, if a square is positive, a parabola looking like this. You see? So whenever we have a quadratic function, will be some kind of convex structure. You smile. Why are you smiling? Because you have Bavarian Abitur and you recognize this, right?
Of course.
That's the formula of the famous mathematician Binomi. Okay, good. He was not a mathematician. So that's how this looks in 2D. Yeah, so you have this convex type of function, and you have to find the minimum. Huh? And it took us a lot of time to copy this from a book, because we weren't able to come up with this type of ideas from our own, on our own. And here is again the setup of the function. There is a typo. I told you last week already that there are way too many typos in this set of slides. This should be a square, right? Because if you just have the norm, it's the length, so it should be the square root of it. And then you compute the gradient. How to compute the gradient? We know that already. I did that last week again on the blackboard. And if you have matrix vector terms and you want to compute the gradient, you should look into the matrixcookbook.com. There you find all the formulas. If you don't know the formulas and if you don't find them, one idea how to come up with the formulas is to write all the matrices and vectors in terms of its their components, do the computations, and bring it back into matrix and vector notation. Yeah, it's a pain, but it can be done really step by step, but it's very, very technical and not fun doing things like that. So you compute the gradient, and then you just say, okay, I evaluate the function at a certain point, I follow the negative gradient, evaluate, follow the negative gradient, and so on, and iterate until the whole thing converges. Yeah, and one necessary but not sufficient criterion is that the gradient is zero, and that's the closed form solution, and the iterative scheme is set up in a way that you are getting closer step by step to the, in this case, even global minimum by just follow the gradient, the negative gradient. Yeah? So you have x in the iteration step k plus 1 is the previous x minus the gradient weighted by lambda, and lambda just tells you how far you've, or how much you follow the gradient into a certain direction. Yeah, if you make it too small, you are more or less sure that you are not overshooting the minimum, but it takes very, very long. And if your gradient scaling is too high, then you might go into the wrong direction. For instance, if you follow at this point the gradient too much, then you end up, for instance, to be here, and then you overshoot. That means you failed the minimum, and then you're coming back from the other side. And if it's not properly chosen, you might jump just around the minimum you are looking for. So that's a very simple approach. It's also something we do quite a lot. If we start to look at a problem, gradient descent is usually not a bad choice. In particular, if you have the gradient here in analytical form, you follow it, and then you see what happens. When I was a student, and even when I was a PhD student, I quite often was very eager to come up with closed form solutions for gradients, because from a mathematical point of view, it's way nicer, everything in closed form. You have the nice formulas, and you can type it in software and evaluate it. My personal experience is that most of the time, numerical gradient computation is way faster, as good, as even better in many, many cases than using the analytical solution. And how do you compute a numerical gradient? Well, you look at the function at point x, you look at the function at point x plus an epsilon. Yeah, you compute the difference and divide by the epsilon, and you make the epsilon very small, and you just look what your machine precision is, and you take a very, very small epsilon, and then you get the derivatives in x, y, z, and whatever direction, and very, very fast, you get a very, very solid estimate of the gradient. It's most of the time way better. So if you attend a talk where somebody is showing to you, and now I compute the gradient, and blah, blah, you have a huge term where the gradient is computed in closed form, one intelligent question is, why don't you use the numerical gradient? Isn't it faster? Isn't it more robust? And things like that. Because if you have many numbers that are multiplied with each other and some ratios and some mappings of numbers, and if you have large terms, you run into machine precision issues. Also the question, how do noise, or how is noise affecting all these computations? And quite often it's better to use the function right away, yeah, instead of computing the gradient analytically. So keep this in mind. Yeah? So when you are required in industry to do an optimization, first shot is do it this way, and then you can tell your boss, now it requires me 4 weeks to compute the analytical version of the gradient, yeah, because I'm sure it can be computed. And maybe that your boss was at school and he knows that computing the derivative can be done analytically, and it's quite hard quite often. And so explain to him, it takes you 4 months, 2 months, 4 weeks, whatever, and you just compute it numerically. Yeah? You have one routine that computes a gradient numerically. You just pass the function pointer and the list of arguments, and you're actually done, and everything is working usually quite well. Huh? Good. So that's something you have to learn. Yeah, tell your boss that things are very complicated, and use the easy approach. If you run in the mode that things that are, if you have a good understanding of the problem, that are not as difficult, and you come up with very difficult solutions, they won't work usually. Yeah? The complicated things usually do not work. It's the simple approach that works. Again, another example for a gradient descent method. And here you see you have a function where you, for instance, have here a valley with multiple solutions, and the question is, how do you select one proper solution out of the set of possible solutions? And what we do is, quite often, we add here an additional regularizer that constrains the solution. For instance, the solution has to be smooth, or the solution has to be sparse, or the solution has to be as close as possible to one previous reconstruction result of one of the same patient, or things like that. So you can select out of multiple solutions one unique solution for your reconstruction problem. Okay. So reconstruction, when in an algebraic setting, is reduced to an optimization problem. This can be solved analytically in closed form, but this is not feasible. We have seen one geometrical iterative reconstruction scheme where we have considered all the equations geometrically, and the solution is supposed to be the intersections of these linear manifolds associated with each equation. And this, the third stage of reconstruction algorithms that we have considered is that we formalize the reconstruction problem as an optimization problem of a function that is not necessarily quadratic, and then we do a gradient descent or a numerical optimization of this particular function. So you can apply all these smart optimization methods that you have learned in AlgoKS, for instance. Yeah, I think that's the arena where you learn a lot about these numerical methods. Good. And now we do the maximum likelihood expectation maximization. And that's another story here. If you look into the literature, you quite often find names for things that are not properly chosen. And I told you that the term spiral CT is also some kind of misleading, because a spiral is, you know, a curve with increasing radius, and Siemens understands this or interprets this as an helix. That's fine. We know about this, and we can read all the texts. Expectation maximization. For those of you who attend pattern recognition lectures, they know it. Expectation maximization is nothing else but a surrogate for a maximum likelihood estimation. Yeah? But the image processing community, the medical image processing community, is not that much familiar with statistics and statistical methods, and they came up with a name, a maximum likelihood expectation maximization reconstruction algorithm. Yeah? The question is now, is there a non-maximum likelihood expectation maximization reconstruction at all? No, because expectation maximization is a numerical iterative scheme to do a maximum likelihood estimation. Okay, that's a very, very strange naming, but that's the way it's now in the literature, and people are using it. It's the abbreviation is MLEM reconstruction. That's just doubled the type of way we are dealing with things. So the idea now is to replace, and we do that quite often in pattern recognition and also in medical imaging. We replace the F by P and look at probability density functions. Yeah? Now you are saying, how can I replace something by probability? Very simple example that is used quite often. For instance, if you have to solve the following problem, AX plus B is, or AX minus B is zero, you can say, okay, for various axes, XI minus B, sum over I. I minimize this with respect to A and B. This is the objective function I want to minimize. So F of AB is this. How can I translate this into a statistical setup? For instance, you can say, well, AXI minus B times AXI minus B. And if you look at this product here, you see immediately, if you squeeze in here the inverse of a covariance matrix, this is nothing else but the exponent of a Gaussian. Yeah, this is nothing else but the exponent of a Gaussian. And instead of minimizing the difference or the square difference, I can maximize the value of the Gaussian PDF with respect to AB. So I just compute here the exponential function of it, and then the product over all i's, and maximize this. And if the sigma to the power of minus one is just the identity matrix, these two problems are equivalent. Any problems? Where do you have a sigma instead?
No, the sigma is there also on your on the blackboard.
Yeah.
We were just discussing how it in school you learn the Gaussian where you have x minus mu divided by sigma, and there are just other letters.
Okay. The sigma is I mean, in the 1D case, you have this type of notation, right? This type of notation, and you can rewrite this in terms of x minus mu sigma minus 1 x minus mu, and then if you go into the vector space, yeah, then you get here a covariance matrix, an inverse covariance matrix, and here you get the transpose of the vector and the normal vector, so the column vector. So what we do is we reformulate the objective function that has to be optimized in terms of P and maximize probabilities. That's the basic idea of statistical approaches. Our objective function is now set up in a probabilistic framework, and then we find the optimum of the likelihood function. So we try to find the parameters, the unknowns, in a way that our probabilities achieve a maximum. How should we select the parameters that the probability of observing the X-ray projections is maximum? That's the question that we answer, actually. And these optimization problems that are associated with these likelihood functions are often used by the expectation maximization algorithm. that we will not consider in detail here. Okay? Now we look into a way, how can we set up a probabilistic objective function? And let's consider emission tomography. What is the difference between transmission and emission tomography? The source is outside and the source is sitting inside, right? Yeah, that means you have a radioactive material sitting in the human body sending out radioactive rays, and these can be measured. And the probability density function for a random variable R, yeah, to emit a certain amount of energy follows the Poisson distribution. So if I ask a certain point, do you send out something, a certain amount of energy? Do you send out something? This probabilistic model is characterized by a Poisson PDF. Poisson PDFs you should have seen in your lecture on stochastics, probability theory, or statistics. Yeah? Is there anybody in the audience who has never seen a Poisson PDF? Okay, where do you come from?
Physics!
Yes, I'm sure, because physicists are very much known for knowing everything. Okay. If you haven't seen it, you'll learn it here. It's good. And you? What's your background? What?
Medical engineering.
Medical engineering?
Yeah, but I got my bachelor here.
Not here? Where did you get your bachelor?
Rheinland-Pfalz.
You see what kind of wrong decisions you did in the early stage of your life here? Yeah? Where in Rheinland-Pfalz?
Koblenz.
University or Fachhochschule? Hochschule. Hochschule is university and Fachhochschule. So university or Fachhochschule? Huh? Applied sciences. Okay. Yeah, I know that they call themselves Hochschule. That contradicts the way how science is done. Yeah, that's the more abstract term. Hochschule means university and Fachhochschule. And now Fachhochschule says we are Hochschule. We are also Hochschule. So the confusion is perfect. Okay. If you for instance, learn about queuing theory in computer science. Yeah, if you study queues in computer systems, you do a lot with Poisson distributions. And it's also shown in physics that the radioactive decay of material can be characterized by Poisson distributions. Yeah? So I'm a little bit surprised that in physics...
I've never heard that statistic.
You don't have to justify it. It's totally fine. Good. So... we have the Poisson distribution. It's a parameterized probability density function, and it's given by this form. Yeah? And you can also plot the Poisson distribution and see that this is a PDF in terms of the random variable R. And the nice thing is, if you compute the expectation of the Poisson distribution, you end up with lambda. And how is the definition of the expectation of a PDF? So if you have a PDF, P of X, and you want to compute the expectation, how do you compute it? How do you compute the expectation?
Integrate over all random variables and multiply its value with
both. Right. That's the definition of the expectation. Yeah? Usually write it this way, E of X is. What is the expectation? If the PDF is a Gaussian, then the expectation is me. Okay. What is the expectation? If P is a Poisson density function, then the expected value of this random variable R is lambda. The expected value is lambda. And now assume that for each detector element, you observe the energy PI. You observe the energy PI, and the energy PI is generated by a ray going through the object. And for each voxel that we visit, we know that this voxel might have generated a photon that was sent out into this direction with a certain probability that is characterized by a Poisson. The next one as well, the next one as well. And what we consider down there is a sum of random variables along the ray. And that's exactly what's characterized here. And we say the expectation of selected voxel elements for a given projection ray is then given by a linear combination of the activities at certain voxel elements weighted by random variables. So we say for the ith element in our projection, the jth volume element has generated a contribution with this probability. Yeah? So we come up with a probabilistic setup and we say with a certain probability, one volume element J has generated a contribution to the energy that is measured at pixel pi, or at the ith pixel measured by the value pi. And by doing that, we can characterize the whole measurement and the whole observation by a product of probabilities. So we just go over all the projection rays, over all the volume elements, and compute the Cijs and the probabilities for the Cijs, and say we select our parameters in a way that this joint PDF here achieves a maximum. Yeah? So we observe random measures. We know how these random measures are built out of the processes that are happening in the human body. And then we say the probability of observing those random measures that we see on the detector, yeah, is maximized for each volume element. And to compute the probability for all the observations, we just multiply all the PDFs. Yeah, we assume they are mutually independent and the joint PDF is just the product of the single PDFs. And then we compute the maximum of this whole function here. Instead of considering the product, and that's also more a computer science issue, I want to point out if you have a product of probabilities, listen, if you have a product of probabilities, if you have discrete probabilities, you know that the PIs, they sit in a range of 0 and 1. Huh? And if you multiply a lot of numbers in between 0 and 1, what happens? The product shrinks and shrinks and shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. And that's why people in medical imaging or in pattern recognition or image processing in general, they always have to fight with the precision of your digital computer. Still nowadays, yeah, with 64-bit, you run into a problem in terms of precision of your digital system. And one way to deal with this type of problem is, instead of maximizing this, you map the values by a convex function or a monotonic function, not necessarily a convex function, monotonic function, and you maximize, for instance, the product of logarithms. No, the logarithm of the product, and this can be rewritten using the homomorphism as a sum of logarithms of pi's, and then you resolve a lot of problems with respect to the product of numbers in between 0 and 1. And now be careful if you work with probability density functions, meaning if you deal with this with continuous random variables, the PDF values can be above 1, right? Yeah. If you have a PDF, P of X, it's important that P of X is non-negative. And another condition is that P of X dx has to be 1. Yeah, if you integrate over all the X values, this is required to have the value 1. And if you just look at Gaussians, you can do the following. You have the non-negativity. And then you can have a very small variance and can go up and down. The only thing that is required to be a PDF is that the integral is 1 over this here. And that means that the PDF values can be well above 1. Yeah, that's something that students quite often ignore while looking at things like that. Yeah, PDF values can be above 1. Yeah. PDF value for a certain point gives you the probability. If you want to compute probabilities for continuous random variables, you have always to consider intervals. And the intervals are characterized by the area that is covered. Yeah. So please remember this. Be careful. So we compute the logarithm. And the nice thing is that here in this situation, it turns out that the log likelihood function, that's how we call it, simplifies a lot. So you have a linear combination of logarithms. You have a linear term with your aij's and xj's. And you have here the logarithm of cij factorial. And this here is independent of the unknown volume elements. And that means you can just ignore it. It's a constant. Yeah? You can just ignore it. If you have to maximize a function where you just have an offset by a constant that is independent of the volume elements, it doesn't matter. If you move this function here, if you're interested at the point where the minimum sits, it doesn't matter whether you move the function up or down. Yeah? The point of the minimum doesn't change. If you move it up or down along the y-axis, the point of the minimum doesn't change. Things become different if you move it into this direction. So if you have a dependency on the x values. So this is just a constant. It's an offset of the function, and it doesn't affect the position where the minimum sits. Sir? Cij is the random that's basically the activity that we have at point j in the volume that is associated with the projection ray I. For instance, you have your volume. Let's think about a 1D slice. This is the projection ray. So the activities that contribute to this point for all the points that are not sitting on the line is 0. And for those that sit on the line, there we have certain Poisson processes sitting in each volume element. And the Cij characterizes this. And the Cij is independent of the position volume of the voxel values xj, not of the volume position, but of the volume values that are actually there. Good. And the expectation maximization algorithm is now an iterative scheme that allows us to optimize this function with respect to the xj's. With respect to the xj's, and as a side effect, we also have to compute the AIJs, because the AIJs are also not known for us, because we don't know where the radioactive material is sitting in the human body. So we have the situation that we have two random variables that we don't know. One is the AIJs that characterize the radioactivity, or the contribution of each volume element to the measured radioactivity. And the second part is the volume, the voxel value at position J that we don't know. And computing these two types of parameters is a very high dimensional optimization problem that has to be solved. And what people in the literature use is the expectation maximization algorithm to do so. I will not explain now the expectation maximization algorithm. We have mentioned this briefly in the chapter on MR bias correction, where we also talked a little bit about the expectation maximization algorithm. And this method can also be applied here. Instead of optimizing this function, an expectation value is computed that is maximized in a way that you just compute the gradient with respect to the component, set it to zero. And in this case, you get a closed form estimator. And you don't need to know how this is computed. You get a closed form estimator for the voxel elements or for the voxel values. Looks like this is an iteration scheme that allows you to compute the volume given an initialization. That means in the k plus first iteration, the voxel value xj is computed by the xj value in iteration k using this type of iteration scheme. So it's again the same procedure. We have an objective function. Instead of using the likelihood function, we use an expectation. We compute the minimum of the, or the maximum of the expectation value by using a gradient computation. We even get a closed form solution for the gradient, and we can now iteratively estimate the volume that we want to reconstruct. Yeah. Please do not learn these formulas. You should not know these by heart, and you should not remember these. Why shouldn't you remember this? Because the lecturer also doesn't remember it, so he will not ask for it. And if you write it down, once again, I have to check it once you're out of the office and I need to evaluate your exam. Good. So what is the story again? We have transformed Bayer's law into a system of linear equations. We have solved the reconstruction problem by solving a system of linear equations. We have seen a geometric method and an iterative scheme to do algebraic reconstruction. Then we said we want to solve the associated optimization problem numerically, and we did a gradient descent, yeah, an iterative gradient descent method. Then we transformed everything into the language of probability theory, and we maximized the probability for the given observations. And now the last part is regularized reconstruction that is becoming more and more important in the literature nowadays. And I'll tell you how that works. So once again, this is the problem. A is our system matrix defined by the geometry. X is our volume to be reconstructed. P are the observations. We transform this into the optimization problem AX minus P has to be minimized. So far, we have seen approaches where we use the L2 norm. And you can imagine what researchers do. They replace the L2 norm by other norms and look what happens. There are hundreds, millions of papers out there where people have replaced the L2 norm by the L1 norm or LP norm or whatever norm and looked how things behave in terms of reconstruction results. Yeah. You can play around with these things. Question is also, what happens to the optimization schemes if you replace this by the L1 norm and gradient descent in its original form is not working properly? And so a lot of interesting secondary research questions grow out of this. What you also can do is, you can say, instead of minimizing this, some norm, you also say that you have an additional regularizer, let's say lambda times R of X, and you minimize this. And here, you incorporate knowledge about the volume to be reconstructed. This is independent of the measured data P. It's just saying something about the volume to be reconstructed. For instance, this can be smoothness. For instance, you say you compute, for instance, the gradient of the solution, and you want to make sure that the gradient here is small. So neighboring voxels should have similar values. If the reconstruction value is smooth and you do a reconstruction, you have volume element 1 and volume element 2, and they are neighbors. If they are neighbors, they should be as similar as possible. Yeah? So you can say the difference, that means the gradient of this should be small. I want to reconstruct here in a way that the solution of the volume computation ends up with a volume that is smooth in a way that neighboring pixels or voxels have the same or similar reconstruction values. So what we do is we introduce additional information into the reconstruction process to enforce a certain solution. Yeah, to enforce a certain solution. Or another example can be here, as I have already mentioned, sparseness. So what you compute, for instance, is the zero norm of X. That means you just compute the number of non-zero values or zero values. And you want to have the number of non-zero values to be minimal. And you compute a solution where the number of non-zero values is minimal. And the error here between these two is minimal. And usually we incorporate here some prior knowledge about the volume that has to be reconstructed. And you can also add additional terms suppress noise or artifacts. And noise suppression, for instance, can be done by the smoothness term. If you have a high noise level, the reconstruction might jump up and down in neighboring voxels. And if you enforce smoothness by the regularization term, you might also filter out some kind of noise that is present in the projection data. Yeah. So here is an example. You have to solve the system of linear equation, AXSP. That's our AXSP. And you want to minimize, for instance, a transformed version of the reconstructed result with respect to a p-norm. You know about different norms? Yeah, you should have seen this already. So if p is equal to 2, you get the L2 norm. And if p is equal to 1, you get the L1 norm. And if p is something else, you get the so-called general LP norm. So you can require here that the LP norm of a transformed solution is given subject to the solution of this linear systems, and this can be transformed in this type of objective function, this constraint optimization problem here. Yeah. So the psi can be a transformation into a different space. What type of transformation is this here, from here to here? If you look at the image that we are considering, the transformation, how would you implement this type of transformation to compute out of this image? If I give you an image and you have to compute this, yeah? Yeah, basically you compute the edges here, right? You compute the edges and you get here the edge values. It's a little bit weak in a sense here that you have here the black contours. And if you compute the black contours, you will get double lines in, usually you will get double lines because you have a gradient in one direction, to the one side of the black line and to the other side of the black line. So if you do an edge detection using gradients, you will get here parallel lines. So this is a very artificial example here. It's not very nice. Maybe the colleague is not a pure image process, or is not having a very strong image processing background here. Would have been better to just take out the black lines and use the intensity value differences. Then you will end up exactly with this type of figure. Everybody sees what I was saying? Yeah? The black line has on the left side an intensity difference and on the right side an intensity difference. So you would get two gradients that are close to each other in completely different directions. Okay. There are many transformations that you can consider. For instance, the gradient as a mapping. You can compute the wavelet transform. You can compute the Fourier transform. You can compute the discrete cosine transform of the result and enforce certain values at this point. What are the typical regularizers we use at the end of the day? Most of the time, we go for the L2 norm. Why? Is there a good reason why we go for the L2 norm in optimization? Because if we have the L2 norm, we get squares. And if we have squares, we have quadratic functions, and the derivatives of quadratic functions is something we can handle. If we take the L1 norm, we get absolute values. Yeah? And even with a strong mathematical background, you know if you have absolute values, you have these kinks in the functions. Yeah? And the differentiation at those points is something that is not fun. And the optimization associated with absolute values is something that is a little more complicated. We have it well under control nowadays. We can deal with this properly. But it takes some more work than for those cases where we have the traditional L2 norm. And here you see the typo not coming back here. It's the absolute, Euclidean length of the vector, and here you have the square root. Yeah? In previous cases, we did that a little bit wrong. For instance, here, yeah, there should be the square root because it's the original definition of the L2 norm. Then we have the square root. Where? Yes, and I was saying there is a typo on the slides. That was the message. There is a typo. There should be a square or a square root. Yeah. There is a typo. we have to fix that. It's not nice. Good. Two other interesting things. This is, by the way, not a norm. The L0 norm is not a norm. It's just the sum of xi to the power of 0. And a non-zero xi value leads to 1. And a 0 xi value leads to 0. So this is nothing else but a count for the non-zero elements. Okay? The L0 norm, yeah, norm, it's not a norm. L0 type of norm, it just counts the number of non-zero elements. Yeah? And if I want to have a sparse reconstruction, I want to have this number to be as small as possible. And the interesting thing is, if you enforce here sparseness, you run into a discrete optimization problem because you cannot compute here the optimum using analytical methods or numerical methods that are derived from continuous optimization. Was that your beer bottle? Who said yes? Okay. And then if p tends to be infinity, you just get the maximum. Yeah? You get the maximum norm. That means you take the maximum value in your vector. You take the maximum value. So L2 type of norm is the number of non-zero elements. And the other extreme is if p goes to infinity, the norm of the vector is just the maximum value of the components we have. Okay. And here we see two different types. One is the squared or the quadratic function. That means the L2 norm. And here we have the L1 norm. And this is the minimum. And what you see is if you compute the gradient value at the point we are looking for at the minimum, for the quadratic function, we get 0. And for the absolute value function, exactly at this point, we do not get a solid estimate of the derivative. Yeah, we get a derivative from the left and from the right, but at this point we cannot compute actually the derivative because there is a kink. Another thing is that in the L2 norm, values that are far away from zero, they get squared, so they get emphasized. And if you compute, for instance, an error using the L2 norm, that means in your final function, large deviations contribute quadratically to your solution. So if you have a large deviation, you put this quadratically in your objective function. If you have a linear function, like in the situation of the L1 norm, here large deviations from zero end up to be not overemphasized in the final solution, yeah? Or in the final objective function. So if you have to do something like this, you have to compute the sum of ax minus b for all a. You have to minimize this with respect to a and b. If you have large deviations, these large deviations, they contribute in quadratic terms to the sum. So small deviations contribute a little bit to the solution. Large deviations quadratically contribute to the solution. Small deviations are usually sitting in between 0 and 1, yeah, if it's very close. And then you take the power of 2, it's even getting smaller. If you have large deviations, you're on the wrong side of the 1. That means they get a much higher weight. And that means that if you solve things using optimization problems, yeah, if you solve optimization problems based on the L2 norm, large deviations usually bias your result into the wrong direction. And that's why the L1 norm is preferred for many, many reconstruction approaches. nowadays, because we can handle it. Here you can see the unit balls for the different norms. How do you read that? I will not go into detail. You will see this in the lecture on pattern recognition this semester given by Professor Nürth. Here it's just the set of all the x vectors where the norm, the p norm, is equal to 1. Yeah, and if p is equal to 2, we know all the vectors that have the norm 1, they sit on a circle. If we have the L1 norm, all the vectors that have the norm 1, they sit on this diamond structure. And this here is, this cross here is the unit sphere, the unit ball you get for which norm? It's the L0 norm that is actually not a norm. Yeah. Another regularizer, and we mentioned this in particular here because this is used quite often in MR reconstruction nowadays and CT reconstruction. That's the so-called TV norm. TV norm, TV stands for television system. No, this stands for total variation norm. It's very popular because it's a so-called sparsifying transform. That means it tends towards a solution where you have a lot of zeros in the final result without moving from a continuous optimization problem to a discrete one. So how is it defined? It's just the derivative in x direction for the 2D case, the derivative in y direction to the power of 2. Then you sum it up and you take the square root of it. Yeah. So the total variation is just a combination of the gradient, the L2 norm of the gradient combined with the L1 norm. So the L1 norm again is just taking the absolute value. Once again, if you have a vector x and you compute the L1 norm or the LP norm, how is the LP norm defined? It's x to the power of p, sum of I, and then you put it to the pth root. Yeah? And if you take the L1 norm, yeah, then you get here the absolute values, the sum of the absolute values. And the L1 norm of the square root of the Euclidean length of the gradient for each position ij in the two-dimensional image we are considering, we just sum up the absolute value of the length of the gradient for each point using basically the L1 norm of the gradient image. Yeah? And that's the TV norm. Compute the length of the gradient, and you sum up the positive lengths of the gradients in the image. Okay. Why can you omit here the absolute values? Because the square root of a number is always considering the positive part of it, right? And the TV norm promotes sparsity in the gradient domain. Sparsity in the gradient domain, that means you get a lot of small gradients. Small gradients mean you have what? You have a smooth function, small variations in local neighborhood. It suppresses noise, it preserves edges, and promotes, that means enhances images with large uniform areas where you have no gradients, yeah, zero gradients, and sharp boundaries. And the TV regularizer here in the reconstruction part is ideal for phantoms, where you have ideal situations. It turns out that for real world situations, you have to do a little more. If you compute real world volumes using the TV regularizer, you get the so-called staircasing effects or patchy structures. That means you have areas which look very smooth and homogeneous, and then you get another area. It's also homogeneous and smooth on a different level. And that means that the images that you get, they look very artificial. Yeah? They look a little bit like cartoons. And at least the doctor looks at it and says there is some processing performed on the images. And so my trust level is going down in these images. Yeah? So. So here we have reconstruction results. You see, if you reconstruct with the TV norm, then the grayish part here it looks more crispy, yeah, more noisy, and here the noise appears to be a little reduced. That's the impact of the reconstruction. And you see also here, in between these bright areas, more artifacts. Yeah? Here you see more noise. Even if we know that the original image is homogeneous in the whole area, and this noise here is also present, but the overall appearance of the black area looks a little bit less noisier than in the other reconstruction result. And now you can steer and play around with this regularizer by adjusting the lambda. One standard question is, when you see somebody dealing with regularizers, you can always ask the question, how did you choose the lambda? And you will get the answer, we did this by experiments. Yeah? It's one of the most stupid questions because there is no good solution to select the lambda. Yeah? That's always something where heuristics comes in and where each engineer has his own favorite values to choose the lambda, but usually it's very, very heuristic. And if you read papers where regularized reconstruction is performed, usually you do not find so much information about the selection of lambda. In the worst case, you do not even see what was chosen for lambda. Yeah? So the results are not reproducible at all. And now, yes, sir. Of course, you can get problems with the lambda.
Isn't this really bad? I mean, obviously, I want to reconstruct.
Of course. Population. Of course. I mean, you can take a value that works well in average, but there are always situations where the lambda can be adjusted better to achieve even better results for a particular patient. So that's a trade-off you have to deal with. Yeah. And now research comes back into the game. If you look at this type of optimization problem, if you think about filtered back projection, you can think about different characters pushing forward different approaches. All the filtered back projection guys will tell you this is more efficient and the results are sufficient and blah, blah, blah. And the algebraic reconstruction guys tell you, yeah, I can put it so much information here, and it's a new generation of reconstruction algorithms, and the reconstruction results look nice. And then if you step back and if you look at the two communities, of course, there is a valid question asking, in which case are these two methods identical? Yeah, in which situations do I get identical results? And there are theoretical results showing that the algebraic reconstruction with a TV regularizer is identical to filtered back projection with a subsequent edge preserving filtering. What is edge preserving filtering? Edge preserving filtering means you flatten areas where you have homogeneous regions and where you have edges. You do not apply the flattening procedure. one typical representative for edge preserving filtering is?
Median
filtering. Yeah, that's a very good example for that. And on Thursday, we will see the bilateral filtering that does the same. So Bruder has shown if you start to do algebraic reconstruction with TV norm regularization and you solve your system of linear equations with 5 to the power of 12 unknowns, you get the same result as you get if you just perform filtered back projection and then you use the volume and perform edge-preserving smoothing retrospectively to the volume. And that's interesting, yeah? Yeah? And then you can say, okay, in terms of image quality, they should be very similar. Of course, for what lambda is this true? And there are many idealizations in it. But at some point, the message always is, if you have an algebraic reconstruction algorithm, you will find a filtered back projection type of reconstruction method that leads to the same results. And I had one PhD student in my lab, that was his hobby. You know, if he was reading a paper on algebraic reconstruction showing that the reconstruction results are outstanding and superior to anything that was known, he just looked into it and found a way how to do this same result with filtered back projection reconstruction method combined with filters. Yeah? And in terms of efficiency, that means the guy with the algebraic approach was computing days, and we were able to do that within milliseconds or a few seconds, yeah, depending on the size of the volume. And that's nice to see these two communities fighting each other with the best reconstruction algorithm. And I enjoyed a lot seeing the guys in my lab coming up with smart filtered back projection type of reconstruction algorithms that do the same like these algebraic methods. So at this point, theory is very important. Which one?
I mean, why are people doing it? It takes so much longer if they get the same results.
Yeah. Now, if you see the papers, they claim that the image quality is superior. So, if they do the image quality assessment of the reconstruction results, for many algebraic reconstruction, it's superior. And another argument is, and at this point, filtered back projection algorithms are really not doing as well as the algebraic ones if you have limited angle reconstruction. So if you don't have a rotation around the object, but only 30 degrees or 60 degrees, algebraic reconstruction do way better. Yeah, that's basically going exactly into this direction. For the filtered back projection, you have to make sure that you get all the projection rays to sample the Fourier function or the Fourier transform properly. And in algebraic reconstruction, the association with the proper sampling of the Fourier transform is not given this way. So there are some advantages, but if you, and that's the point, if you use medical scanners that do anyways the sampling in a proper way, you exactly have the setup that you most of the time find a smart filtered back projection variation that comes up with the same image quality like algebraic reconstruction methods. Yeah? That's not true for mammography, for instance, where you have just a limited angle to rotate around the breast and to do the breast reconstruction. Yeah, the advantage is filter back projection is much faster and supported by many, many systems. Yeah, you have this type of optimization problem, your regularizer, your similarity term, and which one you weight by the lambda doesn't matter. Either you put the lambda here or lambda there. They have different weights in the scheme. And then you do the reconstruction. And if you read the literature, a lot of things are related to compressed sensing. That's a very nice buzzword. Nowadays, we do compressed sensing reconstruction. And compressed sensing reconstruction is usually nothing else but doing a regularized algebraic reconstruction, and most of the time the P is set to 1. Yeah? Compressed sensing is nothing else but the L1 regularized solution of a linear system of equations. So once you hear that term compressed sensing, then you can just say, you mean an L1 regularized solution to a linear system. That's nothing else but what is done in compressed sensing. What you also can do is you can incorporate now additional information. For instance, here you can say the reconstructed volume should be very similar to a prior volume. For instance, if you have a preoperative CT data set and you get a patient on the table and you do a reconstruction, you can say the reconstruction I'm doing now should be very similar to the reconstruction I did one day before. And you can enforce the solution towards this direction, sir. No.
Where do they come from now?
Constraint optimization. We are running out of time. If you have constraint optimization, let me just close it now. Like this. F on X has to be maximized subject to, let's say, the length of x is 1. Yeah? Then you can replace the optimization problem by the Lagrange multiplier and minimize this instead. Yeah? So the lambda is nothing else but a Lagrange multiplier. The regularization weight is a Lagrange multiplier in the language of optimization. Okay, so thank you very much and see you on Thursday.